very much for being here. It's delightful to see you. And welcome to Lauren's Space Pod 2012 on The Space, a new way to enjoy the arts, free and online this summer. I'm Lauren Laverne, and in this episode, I'm exchanging my shiny space capsule for an equally shiny new construct on Terra Firma, the Serpentine Gallery's summer pavilion here in the verdant setting of London's Hyde Park. With me, my 2012 festival sidekick, erstwhile space monkey, John Holmes.
I am actually a monkey under these clothes, that's fair.
I've had a look, he is. Together, we're going to be taking stock of the festival as it approaches its closing stages with the help of a specially invited audience. Hello, audience. That's them. And a cast of luminaries, including John, the First Lady of the Festival, Ruth McKenzie.
And the First Lady of Dance, Arlene Phillips, will be with us.
With us also one of the most widely acclaimed performance artists working today, Bobby Baker. And as the Bard becomes a pop-up phenomenon, John, what are you going to
do? Well, apparently I'm going to be getting myself Shakespeared, but I'm not entirely... I hope the word shake is still on that, otherwise I'll just be getting speared and no one wants to necessarily...
Agonising, yeah. at least our
Don't
listeners...
Don't say yes, what are you doing?
At least our listeners will be spared the visuals, yeah, but for the audience, horrifying. Looking forward to that, John.
Yes.
All that and music too. Please, everybody here, put your hands together and welcome our lovely audience, Mitch Benn.
Hello, everybody. It's entirely possible you have no idea who I am. That's cool. No particular reason why you would. For those of you who don't know, I'm a comic songwriter, an occasional satirical comic songwriter, which means I sometimes have to turn my attention to the issues. Big issue at the moment is gay marriage. Very divisive issue, but as divisive issues go, a curiously one-sided one. Case in favour of gay marriage is extremely simple. It's one word, equality. There you go. Case against gay marriage, altogether cloudier, altogether more nebulous, not entirely sure. They seem very vehement about it, but they don't seem to be entirely sure what their case is. So I've had a bit of a research. I think I know what the case against gay marriage is, and if they're not going to articulate it properly, then maybe I should. If the gays are allowed to marry, it'll be disastrous. And it's not because they're sinners and not as good as us. It'll undermine the institution in every way. Cause you see, what'll happen is, no, wait a minute, what we really mean is, look at just damn well, okay. The Church of England says gay weddings would destroy marriage, and it should know. It was founded for the sole purpose of destroying a marriage long ago. It'll spell the doom of the tradition. Just wait and see. If we let more people do it, no, that can't be right. Wait, hang on just a second, look, it really will, honestly. And it's forbidden in the Bible, you've been warned, right next to the passage prohibiting prawns and shaving and wearing mixed fabric clothes. But those bits of nonsense every Christian knows. But the bit you can cling to, the bit that's true, is the bit that tells us we're better than you. And it's okay to bully and discriminate. Give us a break here, we're running out of people to hate. Can't hate the Jews no more. We're too scared to hate the Muslims. Cause being gay is a lifestyle choice, the evidence is strong. Cause if it's not, they're just born that way. It means God isn't nice or the Bible's wrong. Our values must be defended, of this let there be no doubt. And it's not just because they're weird and unnatural. Look at that, two men holding hands, and now they started kissing, and I bet they fiddle with each other. Blur, make them stop, they're yucky and they freak us out.
Mitch Benn, whose solo show Reduced Circumstances was one of the highlights of this year's Edinburgh Fringe. Now, John, you've been going culture crazy over the run of our podcast series. How's your summer festival been?
Well, it's been great, actually, Lauren, because I've managed to go to see quite a lot of things within the festival. And I've been running over hills dressed in Tron light suits.
Up off the seat.
Again, not a euphemism. I have been intervening in the war between Christians and Muslims. That was something I had to do. And I puzzled over a string quartet hovering above Birmingham in four separate helicopters. That was something that was quite... I wasn't allowed in the helicopter due to health and safety reasons.
Pretty much an average summer for you.
Very much an average summer for me, yeah.
Yeah, that's the usual type of thing you get up to.
Oh, always. Yeah.
Okay, well, now let's meet the woman responsible for programming our Summer of Art and Culture. She's persuaded some of the world's leading artists to take part, crisscrossing the country repeatedly over the past 3 months to give her personal backing to many of the events and commissions that have formed the 2012 festival. And in fact, she's continuing to do that today. Please welcome everybody, Ruth McKenzie. Welcome.
Thank you.
All right, Ruth. Thank you very much for joining us. So 12,000 events, world premieres galore. We've had 900 venues involved, 25,000 artists from all the participating Olympic and Paralympic nations. I mean, you must have the best contacts book in the business.
Well, I certainly do now. And what's been great is I have been, as you say, racing around the country to see these commissions. So we commissioned these artists and we said, look, it's a special summer. We're never going to see the Olympic and Paralympic Games in this country again. So please, will you do something that is as once in a lifetime as the games themselves? And actually, these artists have done the most incredible series of extraordinary things, and you heard about them, including 3 camels and 4 helicopters and 2 choirs were in that event in
Birmingham. That was just one opera.
That's just one opera. That's right. That's right.
Stockhausen.
But we've had the most extraordinary time. And what we hope, and we'll have to come back next year and find out, is that we've created some of the great memories of the summer. So it won't just be the extraordinary athletes, it'll be some of the extraordinary artists as well.
OK, so take us back a little bit, Ruth. 2010, you're sitting there, presumably with, you know, the either metaphorical or literal blank sheet of paper in front of you. How did it feel?
Well, everyone helpfully said that we were 2 years too late. And most people mentioned that having, you know, a budget and some staff would be good too. So we were up against it in terms of time. But the great thing is that when you've got no time and no money, you're just calling in favours and you're asking people to be mad and to have the most ambitious, crazy idea in a way without the benefit of restrictions. Mm. And that, I think, has turned to our advantage, actually, that you say, really, once in a lifetime, just give us the biggest thing you've ever wanted to do and let's see what happens.
Wow. Do you think, Ruth, the whole of what's been happening with the festival and how the Olympics, do you get the feeling from where you're sitting that it has sort of brought normally cynical, miserable British people together and made us sort of celebrate the whole thing? Has it really played a part in that?
Yeah, I do. I think we've all celebrated extraordinary talent has been the great thing. And what's been lovely about the festival is we could take talent all over the UK, you know, from Shetland down to the Isles of Scilly, really all over the UK, and we could offer a huge range of stuff for free. We think that we're going to have over 10 million free tickets and opportunities taken up. I mean, starting with people like Rihanna, you know, Jay-Z, Dizzy Rascal, Florence and the Machine, Radio 1 Hackney Weekend was at the opening weekend of our festival. Amazing.
Well, was there a key commission like that, that once you got that, the floodgates opened and it all became a lot easier?
That's such a good question, because you're right, artists love to know that other artists are involved. So one of the first artists that we invited was Damon Albarn. Damon Albarn, who I'd worked with before on an opera, that's in inverted commas for those that haven't got the benefit of visuals, called Monkey Journey to the West, which in fact combined music and circus. And he did another opera for us. And of course, he's now on a train, the Africa Express, going around the whole of the UK, taking African musicians to every station he can get the train to come into.
Okay, so he was a key kind of player.
He's a key player because everyone loves him. So if Damon's in the festival, then others will come in. Alafer Eliasson, the incredible visual artist who did the Weather Project, he was another early adopter, if you like. And Deborah Warner, wonderful director, also said yes to doing Peace Camp, a fantastic thing about love poetry in beaches around the UK.
I mean, in view of the number of commissions that people must have applied for or, you know, tried to get involved, were there some people that you had to let down, and how did you deal with that?
Gosh, that's a hard question. Well, there's never a good way to say no. But I found that the best ideas are the ones that come from the heart. The worst ideas were the ones where people try and second guess, you know, where they go, OK, I know, if we combine 6 different Olympic and Paralympic sports together with 5 art forms, that would add up to something irresistible. But it doesn't, of course. It adds up to something that doesn't really sound terribly
confusing.
But one of our most important, I think, initiatives is going to prove to have been Unlimited, and you're talking to Bobby Baker soon, but Unlimited, which is the largest ever sum of money that we've been able to offer any time in this country so far for disabled and deaf artists, has produced, I think, some of our greatest work and some of the work that's going to be the most game-changing, as game-changing, I hope, as the Paralympics themselves.
OK, well, final question for you. We're, you know, legacy time now. What happens next? Obviously, the baton culturally is about to be handed over to Derry, Glasgow and Rio in 2016. What would you like to see happen?
Well, I think Rio have been very engaged with us in terms of working with disabled and deaf artists, have got a challenge now to offer more opportunities to disabled artists. That would be fantastic. I think that having shown what happens when you give artists the chance to make large-scale work outside artistic institutions, you know, out in the streets or in the mountains or on the beaches, I'm hoping that the Arts Councils and Derry and Glasgow will pick up that baton and run with it, and I'll be able to take off my Brazilian shoes.
They are astounding shoes, by the way, for the benefit of those who can't see.
They are astounding, and celebrate by having a few evenings in.
Okay, well, we wish you the best of luck with that. Thank you very much, Ruth McKenzie.
Thank you.
Well, it's showtime now, or more accurately, show and tell time with performance artist Bobby Baker, much of whose work draws on food and cooking. Mad Gyms and Kitchens is her latest production, and it draws on a history of illness to cook up a recipe for wending your way to wellness. Welcome, Bobby. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Bobby, hello, first
hello.
Of all, welcome. And you have a prop. What is this that you've got with you?
I bought one prop for my show just to give a kind of mini taster session.
Okay.
So that people can get the idea.
All right, well.
Of how good I am at being well.
Over to you. In that case, you better show us.
If you could just help me turn it round. I would normally put it up, but I might. Here we go. I'm sure you don't know who this is. I don't look like that, do I? Oh, well, anyway, I drew it. It's me. It's a medical chart, really. It is a diagram of me ill, and it's about 2007, and look now. So I can only just take you on a lightning trip of my illnesses. I'm probably best known, because I've been so open about it, for having been mentally ill. And so you get a lot of diagnoses with that, a lot of labels, personality disorder, mood disorder, cyclothymic mood swings, eating disorder, anxiety disorder, depressive disorder, so on. But I did get better. But also what kind of got overlooked was the physical side and what happened with the side effects. So I've also had breast cancer and I've got osteoarthritis. I've got one bionic knee. And I'm just about to get another one. And look, I'm nearly there. I've had 8 operations and 3 more to go. And voila, I know all about it. And I want to kind of give the message that you can get out the other end. But I'll just say, to finish off, that when you've got a lot of labels attached to you and kind of serious illnesses, because they are, people get rather overwhelmed. And also, I've been so open this week, people say, how are you? How are you? And it's gone on for years. And I was brought up in Sidcup, so I'm a very polite person. So I always go, fine, fine, thank you. But in my head these days, because I am such an expert at recovering, I just think, better than you. Thank you.
Bobby. Thank you very much for that little taster of your show, Bobby Baker. Now, the show has sold out its run at the South Bank Centre, hasn't it? That must be a really good feeling.
It's great. Well, it's quite a small audience, so I always find having a small audience and selling out is good.
What is it that you think people are connecting with about what you do?
We've been all around the country, because the idea of the show, Ruth was talking about the opportunity to do something you'd not done before. And I wanted to create a small, exquisitely formed show that reached the parts other shows don't reach and engages with people where they are. I think it's funny, it's honest, it's all true. And I've just got the most extraordinary top tips. But the bit behind it, really, is that the point of it is not about me, because I would like people to come away thinking about what they're good at. You know, we're all actually pretty good at it. So the show turns round into being about the audience and what, you know, with no embarrassment, no awful audience participation stuff.
Okay.
And there's tea and biscuits.
Oh, well, that's
I think that's always, kind of like, you know,
that's
a clincher. Unique selling point.
Do you think, Bobby, people, because you're being very open and honest about this, obviously, in the show, do you think people tiptoe around illness as a general, because you're saying about people sort of saying, how are you? We say that to everybody, but do we really mean it when we ask it?
Well, people only ever don't say fine, sorry to interrupt, in EastEnders. You know,
I know.
It's terrible.
But also, you don't really want to know the whole thing, so you've got to be a bit boundaried about it. But I think I just am quite passionate about the fact that there are so many good things, and also you can become an expert yourself. And I was thinking about cancer, you know, 20-odd years ago. It was so frightening and stigmatised. And yet with mental illness, with something that's hidden, it still has so much fear attached, and it is one in four people will experience it. Mm. So I just thought I was such a shining example. I should volunteer myself.
You certainly are. Well, thanks for that. I mean, as you say, you've been touring the country. You've been, I think, to Bath, Walsall, Newcastle, Leeds and Sheffield. Have you felt part of a kind of groundswell of interest in the 2012 festival about us?
Yeah, it's really great. And also, we've really done a lot of subtle networking. So all sorts of people being coming around and coming in. And, yeah, it's really exciting. I'm passionate about the Olympics. So when I knew there was this money, I thought, oh, it's got to... It's got to be part of it.
Well, but I would imagine that you stood a really good chance because you have done some rather amazing things in your past as a performer. Tell me about the life-size edible versions of your family that you once made.
Well, that was in 1996 when I was 26. I sort of discovered cake, and I decided to make a life-size version of my family, and it was in a prefab in Stepney, and then I wanted the local people to come in and eat it. It was technically challenging.
Was there a tastier member, the tastiest member of the family? Or?
I think me. Yeah. I was the baby, and I just vanished. It was quite a shocking show. I gave up. I did lots of things out of cake, but I had to give up because of my teeth.
You had meringue ladies that you danced with as well, didn't you?
Oh, that was a phase. Yeah, I still bring them out occasionally. I used to dress up like them, not now.
The show is part of the 2012 Festival's Unlimited season of commissions for deaf and disabled artists. And far from being stigmatised or at one removed from the festival, you've said that you found it one of the buzziest parts of it. Is that right?
It's amazing. I'm really proud because I've worked in all sorts of festivals and contexts to come into this arena, this opportunity, because it's such an opportunity to learn from each other and for the public to engage with it. And there's the most extraordinary work. And it's down at the South Bank and it's just buzzing. It's really thrilling to be part of it.
Can I ask one? Sorry. I was just going to ask a very important question, actually, which is, if you were making Laurel and I out of cake, what flavour cakes would we be? What kind of cakes? I'm sorry to put you on the spot, and I know it's a difficult question.
I think green tea
cake. Do you know,
I
recently had a green tea cake, and it was
really
spectacular. Mm. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's intuitive.
Mm. So you get green tea. What do I get?
I
Builder's tea cake.
No, you'd be a lemon drizzle.
Of course. Oh. I'm more than happy with that, I'll tell you.
It's John all over. Perfect. Thank you very much, Bobby Baker, everyone.
Thank you.
Bobby Baker, thank you. And if you missed Bobby's performances, fear not, you can watch a short film about Bobby and Mad Gyms and Kitchens right here on The Space as part of the Push Me series of shorts. Now, Arlene Phillips, you are still with us, cutting a dash in our architect-designed home from home here. What do you make of it? Highway has done a good job, hasn't he?
A brilliant job, particularly as it was long distance and faxed in or...
Yeah, I think it was done on over email.
Yeah, how do you even imagine it? Ceiling's a little low, a little bit like a garage, but... Hey, you can't have everything, can you?
Oh, well, more from you in a little while, Arlene. Thank you very much for hanging out with us. Over to you, John, now.
Right, well, look, you've heard, Lauren, I'm sure, of pop-up toasters.
Yes.
You're familiar with those pop-up books? You've probably heard of those.
Sure.
Pop-up bras, are they called that? Or is it... They might be push-up bras, I don't know. Anyway, my point stands.
Bras gone wrong.
Now, the world of all things pop-up gets cultural, as the London 2012 Festival has also seen pop-up Shakespeare, flash mob performances of the Bard's works, forced on innocent shoppers, diners and tourists... and sirens in and around London. One minute you're minding your own business, the next a bewigged actor is shouting the tempest in your face. Now, Jonathan Moore is the project's director. One of the actors, Johnny Fiore, also joins me. She's de-wigged at the moment. Jonathan, I'll come to you first. I said it's Shakespeare forced on people, right? Which it technically is, right? But Shakespeare, I would argue, has that reputation because we all kind of learn Shakespeare at school where we think it's boring and it's forced upon us. Why is Shakespeare the forced upon us playwright?
Yeah, and I once heard about a teacher giving lines lines to kids of Shakespeare as a punishment. You know, I'm going to get them to enjoy Shakespeare. So, yeah, it can be a bit forced. But I remember overhearing one of our actors doing it to this kind of street market porter type guy. And he said, God, that's great. He said, what was it? He said, Shakespeare. He said, but I bloody hate Shakespeare. I like that. So it wasn't about forcing it. It was about gently kind of doing it for them and caressing them with Shakespeare. But moment of grace in the day, that kind of vibe. Very courteous, you know, hard for me. But, you know, because they've done me confrontational theatre in the past, punk bands and stuff
Yeah.
So, you know, because when you're going up to strangers, the last, if you're a bad day, the last thing you want is some Shakespearean git sort of going, my liege, you know, something like this. You know what I mean? So it was just about reading people, getting the vibe, sensing the tone. If they feel like they were up for it, then fine. And yeah. If they weren't, then just kind of moving on. Because I don't really like audience participation. If I'm in the theatre, I can't stand it, to be honest. Yeah. But this wasn't like that. It was more. It was just more.
It was gentle.
Yeah. Okay. Much more
well,
gentle
we're gonna than that. We'll talk a bit more about it in a moment. But we have, of course, been out with the space microphones onto the streets to catch some of this in action.
Peter. Hello, mate. How you doing? I feel like the king of the world.
I see you, William.
Shake it out.
So, well, you know, no one's hit anyone. That's the first thing I'm going to take from that clip, which is a good thing. And, Johnny, you've been out there actually doing it and performing it.
Yes.
Do you find it an easy thing to do to go up to people and...
I like people.
Yeah.
I enjoy talking to people. And the point of the exercise is to make it more humane for us to talk to one another and engage in conversation. Because 9 times out of 10, some people don't talk to other people. They look away. So what we did was...
That's the British way, Johnny. It's what we do.
Honey, don't tell me. I've been here 16 years. but what we did was very, very gently. And 9 times out of 10... people knew the Shakespeare that we were quoting them.
Sure.
And they really enjoyed it.
Do you think people know more Shakespeare than they actually think?
Yes, they do. Absolutely.
Yeah.
We all do. We all do.
So why is that? It's just because so many phrases have become ingrained in society.
I think so many phrases have been ingrained in society and we hear it more often than not. And it's the bard, man.
Yeah. Jonathan, I'm going to come to you now. And I'm going to say, why does it lend itself to so many different performance styles? Because as part of the festival, I went to see a performance of Macbeth in Edinburgh, which was basically an allegory of the war between Christians and Muslims, and they just sort of transposed Macbeth. But this happens all the time with Shakespeare. It's easily made modern. It's popping it up. Yeah. Why does it work so much?
I think the thing about it, if you actually hit on a truth about the human condition and what it is to be human, it doesn't really matter about the historical specificity of that. I think it just talks down the ages, you know, and it still feels like it was written yesterday for me. It's like sometimes it's like Hendrix or Stravinsky or something like that. It still sounds now. It still sounds kind of avant-garde, really. And I feel like the same about Shakespeare, that because it's true and it's the real deal, it can actually
speak. And contemporary.
It has a universality outside the parameters of the specifics at the time it was written. Because it's touching on a truth about humanity, and I think that's what people recognise from all generations. I mean, my mum's family are Irish, and, you know, Irish Catholic, and the whole thing of like, he was one of us, Shakespeare. he was Irish. Patrick Shakespeare. Yeah. You know. And I think that's the kind of thing that a lot of cultures feel that, and a lot of people around the world feel that he's one of theirs because he does speak to all humanity and all times.
And that's why it's sort of acceptable to go and shout it in strangers' faces.
We didn't shout at anybody.
John, I believe
you didn't share it.
And I want you, could you gently share some of it with us now?
I shouted at you.
I don't want you shouting at me, Johnny. Can you just pop me up some Shakespeare?
This royal throne of kings, the sceptred isle, this earth of majesty, this seat of Mars, this other Eden demi paradise, this fortress built by nature for herself against infection and the hand of war, this happy breed of men, this little world, this precious stone set in the silver sea which serves it in the office of a wall or as a moat defensive to a house against the envy of less happier lands. This blessed plot, this earth, this realm, this England.
Come on. Come on. And I'll tell you what. I think I think Shakespeare was meant to be heard in an American accent, don't you? That was that's the best bit of American accent I've heard. That's either that or the comeback of Dallas for me this week.
Oh, shut decide. Up!
Anyway, give them a round of applause. That was fantastic. Thank you, Laura.
There is a theory that Shakespeare's accent would sound American to our ears now because it was preserved, wasn't it, when people
exactly right.
moved...
I mean, Johnny's doing it so beautifully because she's doing it with her own voice. You get the American actors to do that, to be or not to be, you know, that kind of cod English thing. And in fact, you're absolutely right. The Elizabethan way of speaking was much... It was apparently a mixture of kind of West Country and Cockney.
Yeah.
So it's much more similar to the way that Johnny's just done it. So,
there you go. Excellent. OK. Well, if music be the food of love, then play on. That's exactly what we're going to ask Mitch Benn to do right now. Mitch, welcome back. Ladies and gentlemen, give him a warm welcome. Mitch.
Were you following the Olympics? Tell me you were following the Olympics. What the heck happened there? I was willing to suspend my cynicism as far as maybe it will go okay. The and then we win everything bit I honestly didn't see coming. We were third in the medals behind the Americans and the Chinese. We were top normal country. Extraordinary. When Andy Murray beat Roger Federer on the exact same spot he lost him a month previously and then climbed into the stand to kiss his girlfriend, I thought, right, that's it. We are no longer in the real world. We are now in a Richard Curtis movie. I wanted the crowd to shut up for a second so they could hear the stammering marriage proposal, because that's obviously what was coming next, followed only by the end titles and the Elton John song. But there is one question left unanswered at the end of the Olympics. That is, what's happening with that inflatable Stonehenge? If nobody else has dibs on the inflatable Stonehenge, I want the inflatable Stonehenge. We are the bouncy, 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 on our inflatable stone circle, having bouncy pagan fun. We go bouncing with our robes on, till we all fall in a heap, waving our foam rubber torches and sacrificing blow-up sheep. We are the bouncy, 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 then we let down our stone circle and fold it up for one more year. We are happy and delightful. We are harmless and we're good. We're not mean and scary like in that movie with Edward Woodward. We are the bouncy man, feel free, bouncy, 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 bouncy,
bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, bouncy, absolutely tremendous. Yeah, he deserves it. He's earned it, surely.
He's earned that.
Dallas Henge is yours. Enjoy. Thank you very much, Mitch. All right, then. Well, our final guest is one of the most recognisable faces on television. She's been a West End dancer and a judge on Strictly Come Dancing. She's worked with the Monty Python team and has put Tina Turner through her paces. More recently, she's become an ambassador for the Big Dance, one of the key strands of this summer's 2012 festival. Please welcome Arlene Phillips, everyone. Thank you. Thank you. Well, welcome, Arlene.
Thank you.
How has your festival summer been so far?
Oh, it's been a delight. Mm. I mean, I was one of the Olympic cynics. You know, I was just thinking, I'm never going to be able to get anywhere. The roads are going to be closed. And what did I do? I sat watching from day one with great excitement. And of course, all of this wrapped up in the most glorious arts festival I think there's ever been in Britain.
Have there been any specific commissions that have really grabbed your attention, stood out for you?
Well, of course, as an ambassador for big dance, anything that had to do with dancing to me was a thrill and excitement. And there seemed to be so much dance on. I was just enveloped in dance. But I think, you know, one of the sort of funniest moments was the launch of Big Dance at Paddington Station.
Well, yes. I mean, I was going to ask you about this, I have to say. You were paired with an unlikely dance partner, Boris Johnson. He's been an action man this summer. So how did that go, Arlene, for people who didn't see it? Tell us.
I'm just saying that Boris is a Boris, I'll try anything. However, his aides all stand around looking very severe and looking very upset that Boris is getting into entertainment. I don't think they like it. But he's unstoppable. And so
it's just when you've got a dance, Arlene, you're above all
I know.
Other people.
So everybody's going, you know, we need to get this Big Dance 2012 publicised. Go and drag him in. I didn't have to drag him anywhere. He was there on the floor and I was dancing with him and I was teaching him to jive. And he was doing all these little things that started off, you know, with a little hand jive. Okay. He was so into it. He's wild, I'm telling you. I can't imagine what that man is like at home.
Is there anything you think you could do with working on? I mean, you know, obviously you've put some of the greats through their paces.
Yes, I have indeed. I think he needs a little help on the rhythm. You know, he'll go for it, but in fact, dancing in time to the music is not his forte.
Okay. So tell us a little bit more about the big dance. I mean, we think of ourselves, don't we, as a nation of dance lovers. I mean, are we right? Can we really compete with, you know, the Latin Americans on that front, do you think?
Oh, I think the United Kingdom can beat any country in the world on dance. And in 2007, Jacqueline Rose said to me, I've got this idea to bring all dance together. Now, dance is notorious for everybody keeping tightly hold of their own genre of dance, from classical dance to the ballroom Latin world to disco world, contemporary world. She wanted to bring them all together and get everybody out dancing. And everybody looked at her like she was completely crazy. But I have to say, watching this baby grow into this enormous Big Dance 2012, which is now going all over the world. And when you see these groups of dancers getting together, and again, all over the country, you realise football, it's got nothing on dance. People are dancing everywhere, and it's just growing and growing.
Can you coax a series of steps out of just anyone, Arlene?
You know what? I actually can. And yesterday, I took a reporter who said he couldn't dance with a little bit of music and his little recorder round his shoulders. And we started walking, and we started walking in rhythm. And suddenly he was, well, this feels like dancing. And I said, remember John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever, walking down the street with a paint can? Let me tell you, anyone can dance, because walking to music in rhythm, iPods on, a little turn, a little kick, anybody can dance.
Who's your perfect dance partner, Arlene?
Oh, well, I'm a bit of a Fred Astaire lover. I wanted to be in his arms. I wanted to be Ginger Rogers and just float round the floor with him.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, the cultural baton is about to be handed over. Derry, yes. Glasgow, Rio 2016. What's the legacy for the big dance there?
Obviously, what there'll be there in Rio will be incredible sambas, and I can imagine the whole place will be rocking. However, when we come in with our hip-hop and our contemporary dance and our creations like no other, and we take our dance over there and we fuse it all together, I think there could be an almighty explosion.
So we're going to be seeing you in Rio, because Arlene in Rio, that's a TV series.
Arlene in Rio, yeah. I'm there, I've got that samba down.
Amazing. Arlene Phillips, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a great trip. All right, well, we've come to the end of this pop-up version of Lauren's Space Pod 2012. My thanks to Ruth McKenzie, Mitch Benn, Bobby Baker, Jonathan Moore, and Johnny Fiore, and, of course, Arlene Phillips. Thank you very much, everybody, for being with us. audience. Thank you, the audience. Thank you for being here. Before we go, a little reminder that all of The Space is available online now at our website, thespace.org, including a range of films showing our hosts, the Serpentine Gallery's Park Night series, and the forthcoming two-day memory marathon on the 13th and 14th of October. For more on the festival, meanwhile, go to london2012.com/festival. Till the next episode, when my guest will be musician and composer Matthew Herbert, this is Lauren Laverne.
And my name sticker says John Holmes.
Saying goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.